Welcome to episode 42 of Follow the Science. For those of you who are fans of Douglas Adams, you might recognize that number as the answer to the most important question about life, the universe, and everything. What was the question? Well, nobody knows. And I think that that's such a memorable story because it reflects something about us. We humans are, if we're honest with ourselves, kind of a distractible species. And sometimes we do have trouble posing good questions and we can mistake our assumptions for facts. I'm going to be talking to Neil deGrasse Tyson today about questioning and critical thinking on today's episode of Follow the Science, a podcast about science, medicine, and medical misinformation. I'm your host, Faye Flam. I'm a science journalist and a Bloomberg Opinion columnist, and this podcast is funded by a grant from the Society for Professional Journalists. Neil has a new book out. It's called A Brief Welcome to the Universe, which is actually a short version of an earlier book called Welcome to the Universe, based on a very popular Princeton University course. I just read The Brief Welcome to the Universe, and it's great. He really does pack a lot of fascinating stuff in there. So today we're going to talk about the universe. We're also going to talk about critical thinking, about questioning our own assumptions. We're going to talk a bit about UFOs and about what he meant when he said that science is true, whether or not you believe it. I'm hoping we can talk a little bit about, I want to talk about the universe, about your new books, and also something about sort of how people can think about following the science when there's a lot of confusing, sometimes wrong science, pseudoscience, lots of things masquerading as science.
I'm a servant of your curiosity in this session, so don't hesitate.
Why, thank you. I also wanted to point out that you will be episode 42 of my podcast, which I think is awesome.
Cool. Was that on purpose?
It wasn't. It's an amazing coincidence. And I love coincidences. And I also love numbers. So I loved the first chapter in your book, A Brief Welcome to the Universe.
Oh.
One thing I did not know was that you cannot count to a trillion and expect to get there in your lifetime.
Yes, correct. if you take away anything from the book, take that away from it.
Yes, yeah. Do not try this. It would take more than 1,000 years.
Yeah, 31,000 years, yeah.
Lately, Neil deGrasse Tyson has gotten a lot of people really mad at him. Why? Well, because he doesn't believe in something that a lot of people really want to believe in. He doesn't believe that the UFOs that some military pilots have detected are alien spacecraft. There's actually a lot of pretty good science that pertains to the concept of alien life. A lot of it is explained really nicely in a chapter in his new book, Welcome to the Universe. That science includes the detection of thousands of other planets around the galaxy and the discovery that some are positioned in regions that are not too hot and not too cold. The technical term for that is Goldilocks zone. There are also inferences that scientists can draw by looking at the adaptability and early history of life on this planet. And there's also a real effort to look for life elsewhere.
So first, the idea that there might be life teeming in the universe is not, I wouldn't call it optimistic, I would call it realistic rather than optimistic. Realistic because we're made of the same ingredients that we find across the galaxy. And life on Earth took shape very early and very quickly relative to how long Earth has been around. So you correctly laid out that timeline. Shortly after we cooled enough from our molten state at formation, shortly after the temperature dropped low enough to sustain complex molecules that would otherwise be broken apart by high temperatures. Complex molecules based on carbon, which is a very sticky element, and you can make all kinds of molecules with it. In fact, it's the most fertile element on the entire table, periodic table. And carbon is like the third most abundant element. Okay, fourth most abundant element in the universe, a chemically active abundant element. So it's not a stretch to say, oh, what happened here on Earth could have happened countless times elsewhere. And our bias is we assume if it happens elsewhere, it's going to happen on a planet. So we have research projects, telescopes dedicated for finding Earth-like planets orbiting sun-like stars. All right, because we're using ourselves as the model. Now, let me split your comment into two paths. One of them is the search for life at all. And this would be microbes, anything that's sort of self-replicating and thriving in its environment, with a metabolism in its environment. So yes, there's a whole branch of modern astrophysics doing just that, looking for life on Mars, beneath its surface, the icy moons of the outer planets, Jupiter and Saturn. So we're thinking we might be able to find life in our backyard. Okay, that's life of any kind. Now there's SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. That's a whole other branch of what people are engaged in, because that is different tactics. That is, we're assuming that someone out there is intelligent and has technology and wants to communicate.
It seems like it's worth a try.
Yeah, so somebody's got to do it. I put in a little bit of the budget.
Right. It's a long shot, but hey, you know, it would be crazy not to try it.
It would be crazy not to. It's a very high return on what could be a trifling investment of funds.
He brings up something known as the Drake equation, which has been used to estimate the number of civilizations in our galaxy. And it involves some terms that are really well backed up by data, such as the number of stars in the galaxy, the fraction that harbor planets, and how many of those planets are habitable, that is, in the Goldilocks zone. It also includes some terms that we can make educated guesses about. And then there are a few final terms regarding the abundance of intelligence and civilization where we can only make fairly wild guesses.
Fraction of stars with planets, we think we got that. A fraction of stars with planets in the Goldilocks zone, I think we got that. All right, because we have data.
Right, we have real data.
We have real data. We have more than 4,000 exoplanets in the catalog. And 25 years ago, that number was zero. So yeah, we're moving right along. We've got good data. And we get to those last few terms and we have to ask ourselves, what are the chances that an intelligent civilization will actually have technology and want to communicate? They have to have this level of curiosity. We have to estimate that somehow. And how are we even going to do that? Is our conduct inevitable in what might be the intelligence of an alien species? By the way, if it is, then that means that species risks annihilating itself, as we have done many times in the last century, risked annihilating ourselves.
That's another thing we have to consider, that other intelligent species might annihilate themselves in between the time they became smart enough to figure out how to annihilate themselves and the time when they got smart enough to figure out how to avoid actually doing it. Another argument that often gets invoked involves arrogance. Some people say it's arrogant for anyone to think we aren't surrounded by other civilizations. But you could turn that arrogance argument around and say it's arrogant to think any of those other civilizations would really be that keen to visit us.
Who defined us as intelligent? Oh, we did. Oh, okay. So maybe on the scale of the universe, we are drooling, blithering idiots compared to an actual prevailing intelligence that aliens might have. And so the audacity of us to say, let's find other intelligent creatures just like us. And then we discover a life form where we to them look like worms to us.
Those aliens might have more interesting other aliens to study. We might be maybe low on the totem pole.
Exactly. Plus, I'm pretty sure the last time you walked by an alien in the street that was gasping for air after a morning rain shower, and there it is on the sidewalk, either before or after you stepped on it, I'm pretty sure you were not saying, gee, I wonder what that worm is thinking about. Gee. No, you're not having that thought. And maybe we are so far below the intelligence of others in the universe that it is of no interest to them to even contemplate what we're thinking.
And now we get to the part where some people might want to ask harder questions about their own assumptions. Because a lot of assumptions are needed to prop up the belief that the UFOs picked up by pilots are actually space aliens visiting us from elsewhere in the galaxy.
So now, given all of this, we can now ask, have we been visited? Because anyone who's studied this problem will admit, yes, there's likely life out there, probably some of what we would measure as intelligence. Oh, so therefore we've been visited by intelligent aliens? That's a stretch. For many reasons. One of them is, really, the best evidence you have is monochromatic, fuzzy video from Navy pilots flying in restricted airspace. That's your best evidence when we have 3 billion high-resolution video cameras in people's smartphones who walk the earth every day. We have unwittingly crowdsourced any possible thing that could be visiting us. Where is that footage? It's nowhere. Okay. Do you remember, well, in the 1970s, there were all these accounts of people getting abducted. Well, you've got a video camera now. Everybody does. You don't have to tell the alien, wait till I go home and get my camera and come back and we can film
that. That would totally go viral.
It would be viral. Look at the crap that goes viral that has nowhere near that interest. Okay. Plus you could live stream it. And so there's none of this, oh, the alien took my camera and zapped it. No, live stream it while they're walking to you. Oh my gosh, you'd be famous and wealthy overnight. The book contracts, the movie, the serials, the TV serials. So I'm just not impressed with what people have put forth as evidence for being visited by intelligent extraterrestrials. And it doesn't mean they aren't unknown. You know, a UFO, you don't know what it is, and it's flying, and it's some kind of object. Sure. And here's something that some journalists just haven't figured out yet, that the newspaper headline, UFOs are real, ! That headline has no meaning.
Right, because they're UFOs by definition.
Yes, by definition. Yeah. Of course UFOs are real.
Yes. Okay.
You see something, you don't know what it is. It's a real thing. You don't know what it is. Okay.
I don't know. It's, yes. Luckily, I have never written a story where that headline was put over it. Ever. And okay. We'll never see that with my...
Congratulations to you.
The headline I keep seeing recently is, "We have to take UFOs seriously." And some people might think this implies that we have to take seriously the idea that UFOs are alien visitors, but then it's pretty ambiguous and a little weaselly. But now I want to get back to the more general topic of how we recognize real science and distinguish it from pseudoscience. You can't really go by whether something sounds weird because a lot of real science sounds weird, including some of the science that's explained in Neil's latest book. One kind of weird thing is the idea that our universe, vast as it is just one tiny bubble in an even vaster sea of other universes, the whole thing being called the multiverse. And real science can be pretty hotly contested, so you can find physicists who spend a big portion of their time thinking about the multiverse, and then you can find other physicists who say it's just a little too far removed from observation and experiment for them to take it seriously.
The bleeding edge of science is always contested, always. But ultimately, if we can't agree, it's either because one of us is biased in some way that maybe we don't know. But if we're not biased, we will end the conversation with, we need better data in this way to resolve this. Now let's go out and have a beer. You see, so that's the arc of the disagreement on the frontier of science. Right now, the multiverse is a natural consequence of applying theories of the universe that have already demonstrated to work into regimes that will possibly guide the future of exploration. So we didn't pull the multiverse out of our ass. It came out of equations that work in other contexts that make predictable, testable statements about our world. Now we can say, will we ever be able to detect the multiverse? I don't know. That may await another generation to think about access points in our current experiments to it. But just because we don't yet have a way to test it does not preclude whether I should have that idea at all.
I think that is hands down the best, most concise explanation for why the multiverse is a part of legitimate science. Neil deGrasse Tyson takes this multiverse question right into questions about vaccine hesitancy because, well, the connection is an understanding of science, and people need to ask the same kinds of questions
whether they're concerned about vaccines, aliens, or alternative universes.
Now we get to vaccines which have been tested. We get to vaccines that have been tested in millions of cases. We have people, for example, in the Black community who remember the Tuskegee experiments and the very ugly history of medicine and Black people back through slavery and beyond. So that's a very ugly legacy that's very hard to overcome. So, but to say, I'm not going to take it because I don't, because of the history of this against Black people, you realize most of the people who've had the vaccine are white people. Okay.
Right. If the vaccine was so terrible, why are all the medical professionals jumping up to take it?
Correct. So not enough people are asking those kinds of questions about what it is that they believe. And part of what it is to recognize what is true and what is not to believe it outright because an expert tells you, okay? I mean, you might do that because it's easier, but if you want your own brain to participate, it should participate in the way of asking questions. But if you don't know how to ask questions about it, you can chase yourself down a rabbit hole and never come out again and think things like the earth is flat, that vaccines have chips in them, because you are looking at sources that somehow feed your fears and you want to believe them as an excuse for not otherwise following sane expert advice. And so part of me wonders, is this a missing cog in the curriculum of science in kindergarten through 12th grade? Because we look at science, we have a book and it's got information. Here's a DNA molecule and here's this and here's that. Are you ever learning what science is and how and why it works and what role these methods and tools play in establishing what is objectively true in the world? That is a process. And I don't think that's taught in school. And if it were, people would, as adults, would be, dare I use the word, inoculated against charlatans and others who would try to peddle your fears or doubts of science into some other action you might take that would not be in the best interest of your health or longevity or of that of your loved ones.
And you hit on something really important, which is the ability to ask questions. That if you have different sources who sound scientific and you don't know which ones to trust, that asking questions can be the key to staying out of those rabbit holes.
I agree. That's the point. And if you take the UFO case, for example, if you're going to hear startled Navy pilots looking at something they don't understand, and you want to use that as evidence that we've been visited, why not ask other questions? So why not ask, why is the best visual of this fuzzy? You think somebody would have iPhone video out their window of a trailing flying saucer? And we don't. That's all I'm saying. So maybe we are being visited by aliens. I'm not convinced yet. And people get angry with me when I say that, the UFO enthusiast. You'll see, you're not being a scientist. You're not being open to that. So I'm saying, I'm not going to stop you. Keep gathering data. And the day you bring an alien forth, you won't need me to agree with you because it'll be clear and present to everyone who sees it. And I'll be irrelevant and you'll be famous. So don't worry about what I say.
Another thing Neil deGrasse Tyson got attacked for was a pithy little quote that he put out on Twitter. What it said was, science is true, whether or not you believe it. People objected that science isn't a fact or a set of facts, but a process or way of learning about the world. So does it even make sense to talk about it as being true? Another criticism is that science is provisional by nature. Everything is supposed to be open for correction and refinement, or even occasionally replacement. So the state of scientific knowledge today isn't some sort of gospel truth. But then Neil deGrasse Tyson knows all that. So what did he mean by the quote? Well, he'll explain it now, and he also explained it in a 600-word essay that brought out a little more nuance.
I tweeted that long ago, and people say, yeah, that's cool, thanks. And then it ended up on T-shirts and things. And I tweeted it again a few years later, and fights broke out. So it's interesting to watch the ground shift under posted information, and how what we would say in mathematics, the reaction function of the population, of the social media engaged population, shifts. It's important for me to track that, because if I'm going to still claim to be a communicator, I need to know how you're thinking. And if that changes communally, I want to know. Point is, what I make in that follow-up tweet, it's still posted if anyone wants to dig it up, is science and its methods and tools is exquisitely constructed to determine what is and is not objectively true in this world. And by an objective truth, I mean things that are true, whether or not you believe in them. So E equals mc squared, which comes from Einstein's theory of relativity, is true whether or not you believe in it. And we make bombs out of it. You can't say, I don't believe that. Meanwhile, you've just been incinerated by a hydrogen bomb. Okay? So you can't, you don't have the option to not believe in something that is objectively true. How does science establish an objective truth? By repeated measurements and observations that show the same result.
Some of this is really just an argument about semantics, especially the semantics surrounding this notion of belief. Because we say you can believe in angels or believe in heaven, but we don't say we believe in a tree that's standing in front of us or in gravity. I once wrote an essay on this topic arguing that it's sort of nonsensical to ask people if they believe in evolution. Evolution is the best explanation that science has put forth for the tree of life that we observe around us and the way that living things look and act. We don't have to believe in it any more than I have to believe in the periodic table. So if you wanted to be really precise, then instead of saying science is true, you might say science produces reliable knowledge that you can use and it doesn't require belief. But I don't think that's going to get on any t-shirts.
In the era of what I will call modern science, the last 400 years, the era basically of the near simultaneous invention of a microscope and a telescope, right? That all happened in the very early 1600s, and in the era of Galileo forward and Francis Bacon. He was a philosopher scientist who formulated a modern version of the scientific method. Let's just call it that. From then onward, if you measure something to be true and other people verify it, it is not later shown to not be true.
I think that's really important. And I think a lot of the problems that people have been seeing with studies that get retracted later is that's actually the system working, that people try to replicate things and then it doesn't work and that gets thrown out. And maybe too many people believe it based on one study, but that overall, over the long term, the system works and actually does.
That is the entire point of that 600 word thing. And I'm partially implicating journalists here, because the journalist has the urge to break a story that's brand new or controversial. And they'll be based on one study that shows that all the other studies might be wrong. Well, that study is not true unless other studies affirm it. The journalist gains access before that happens, because they want to be the ones that have the big headline. So the public thinks that the science is now there when it's only one study. And subsequent studies come out and don't agree with it. So now it's not a result.
I have to step in here and defend my profession a little bit, because the whole point of being a journalist to me is that someone pays me to take the time to do all that research that you need to put new findings and new events in context. What was known before, and how does the new finding fit in? Well, that's how it's supposed to be done. Unfortunately, he's right that that's not always how it's done in the real world.
And so the public is thinking scientists have no clue what they're doing. Is cholesterol good for you or is it bad for you? Is it good? Is it this? Do I? Is it? And anytime that's happening, it's because these are results on the bleeding frontier. When something is affirmed by multiple studies and multiple observations, it's not later shown to be false. It could be embedded in a larger truth, like Newton's laws of gravity and motion. Got us to the moon, by the way, but we learned that for very high speeds and very high gravity, which fell outside of the experimental sphere of his laws, we needed relativity to figure out the more correct answer. And Do you know something? If you take Einstein's equations and put in low speeds and low gravity, they become Newton's equations, right? So we didn't discard Newton because we found new results that conflicted with it. We broadened our understanding because of it. And Newton's laws are now a subset of a deeper, larger truth that we came to realize.
He's right there. A lot of older ideas in science aren't actually discarded so much as expanded on or refined. And some of the critics who went after Neil on Twitter piled on with examples of things they thought scientists had discarded. But what's really interesting is if you look at the history of science, many of those ideas weren't actually scientific theories or even hypotheses, but just things that everyone in the culture at the time believed. And so the scientists absorbed those ideas along with everyone else. Scientists believed in creationism for a time when that was the prevailing belief, and same with the idea that the Earth was the center of the universe. There really is no evidence, however, that science ever believed in a flat Earth.
So yeah, people decided to fight about it, and all of their counterexamples were either before 1600 or were examples where the science was not yet settled, and they wanted to show that any one scientific project is going to be the truth, and then it's not true 6 weeks later, right? And so it's a problem that people don't understand, again, what science is and how and why it works, because if they did, the world would be a much more stable place. And in all fairness to the crazy things that I can tell you that is going on in the universe, there's another point I'd like to make, that the universe is under no obligation to make sense to you. Our senses derive from our evolutionary arc through the Serengetis, you know, so that is the lion going to eat you or not? All right. These are the kind of thinking we have to go through to become who we were as humans. And in there are not the subtle nuances of how the universe works on its finest scales. So I can tell you the universe was once the size of an atom. And you say, oh, you want me to believe that? Right? Whereas the world looks flat to me, so I'm going to believe it's flat.
This gets back to the problem that you really can't distinguish science from pseudoscience by thinking about what sounds weird to you, because lots of areas of legitimate science might sound weird to a lot of people. But one good way to help make the distinction is to ask the right questions. And one of the best questions is to ask how things work.
So here's one. If someone wants to sell you special healing crystals, right? You can say, oh, that's BS, I'm not going to do it. Or you can say, wow, I'll buy them. Well, each of those steps is equally intellectually lazy. In the first one, you're just denying it. And the second one, you're completely accepting it. It's harder to probe the question, to probe the claim. And that's really what we're missing in our educational background. So you say, oh, what are the crystals made of? In what way do they work? What do people say that it heals? What is the evidence of this? You just start asking these questions, and then the person walks away because they won't have the
answer. Or they'll have an anecdote. They'll say, well, my friend used this crystal, and, you know, she had this terrible backache, and then she wore the crystal around her neck.
The biggest problem in our brain, and advertisers exploit this, is we are more likely to believe eyewitness testimony than we are to believe cold data.
Yes, and that's where clinical trials came from. You know, when I would like to elaborate on the point about the universe being the size of an atom, because you do get into that in your book, and you and Richard Gott, who was a nice addition to the book, got into, I thought a very nice explanation for why people think this is the case. Though even Richard Gott sort of becomes stumped at one point. There was a really interesting passage where he poses the question, okay, so we have these theories that are backed by all kinds of data that actually say, you know, there was this little speck that gave rise to everything, but where did the speck come from? And then he talks about quantum tunneling as possible answer to where the speck came from.
And by the way, quantum tunneling is a real thing.
It's a real thing.
That works every day. So now you say, maybe it applies to an entire universe. Yeah.
So it's a possibility that comes from reality. He's not just making it up. But then he said, here I'm quoting from the from your book. He says, you start with a quantum state corresponding to a universe of zero size that knows all about the quantum laws of physics. How does nothing know about the laws of physics? The laws of physics are simply the rules by which stuff behaves. With no stuff, what do the laws of physics mean? So you face this problem trying to make a universe out of nothing. And I thought, wow, that's just, it is kind of a mind-blowing question.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with mind-blowing questions. That almost all questions on the very edge of our knowledge are mind-blowing. So, and plus, you don't even know if you're asking the right question, right? That's part of that's a double challenge you have when you're there. Is there an answer to the question you're posing? And is the question you're posing even the right question in the first place? So yeah, he's taking it to the edge and he's sort of waxing poetic and philosophical about what it could be. And yeah, that's perfectly natural. And people love that, by the way.
Yeah, no, I love that. I circled that passage because
there you go.
You know, it's such a great mystery that I hope people do chip away at, which is not just where the matter came from and the energy came from, but where did all this order, the laws that make everything predictable, where did they come from?
Right. And you want to get really philosophical in the void of empty space. And you say, here's a region of space where nothing is there. Well, no, the laws of physics are still there.
They're still there, even though there's nothing there, right? Because space, there's space and time, and that...
Laws of physics apply there.
Do you think the flat earthers really believe the earth is flat, or are they just putting us on because it's funny to talk about the earth being flat?
Yeah. I want to believe that they're just putting us on. I want to believe that, but you see other stuff people believe in the world, and flat earth is not the most extreme of what people believe.
So do you think that the sort of questioning scientific mindset can be taught, or do you think that some people are just almost born to be more open to it and others just more susceptible to belief?
Maybe, but I think curiosity is something built into us as a species and is manifested in us very early as children. All children are curious. Oh, what's under the rock? What's behind the leaf? What does this bug look like? Everybody's curious. And curiosity is, here's something I've never seen before, something I don't know about, and I want to probe it further. That's all science is. We're just kids who never grew up. And so I don't think you even have to teach it. You just have to make sure it remains within you through school when it might otherwise get exhausted out of you, where the learning no longer becomes fun. It's no longer the manifestation. It's no longer the fulfillment of your curiosity. And maybe schools should think more about how to turn you into a lifelong learner, perpetually curious, than about how much can we load into you and test you for the final exam. Maybe there's a different mindset that has to unfold there.
Well, I think we got a lot of insight into the misinformation problem in this discussion and how to deal with the problem that misinformation doesn't come with a label. And science does come with labels, but the problem there is pseudoscience. And I think the reason pseudoscience exists is that people do tend to trust science. So charlatans making unscientific claims will go to pretty great efforts to dress those up to look like science. That's certainly the case with some of the COVID-19 claims. Some of them, even the most questionable ones, are made by people with MDs and PhDs. That's why censorship isn't the answer to misinformation. How do the censors know what's real and what's fake? And I don't think the answer is building trust in things labeled as science either. Our brains have to be part of the answer, and we can use our brains to ask questions. Questions of other people, questions of the universe, and questions of ourselves and our own assumptions. Sometimes the answer is the easier part, whether the answer is quantum tunneling or 42, which, in the story at least, was something that was calculated by a computer. So sometimes the part that takes the real ingenuity is figuring out what the question is.
Thank you for listening to Follow the Science. Follow the Science is produced by Faye Flam with funding by the Society for Professional Journalists. Today's episode was edited by Seth Glicksman with music by Kyle Imperator. You can follow us on Facebook for the latest, but if you'd like to hear more Follow the Science, be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast fix.